Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club's InForum, Connect Your Intellect. You can find InForum online at commonwealthclub.org/InForum. That's InForum. You can follow the best of our speaker dialogue on Twitter from our handle at InForumSF and watch video of our past events on Fora TV. I'll also add that my Twitter handle is at Adam Leshinsky and the Lieutenant Governor's Twitter handle is at Gavin Newsom. I'm Adam Leshinsky, Senior Editor-at-Large for Fortune Magazine, and tonight please join me in welcoming Lieutenant Governor of California, Gavin Newsom.
Good evening. Thank you. Thank you.
He has just published his first book, Citizenville, How to Take the Town Square Digital and Reinvent Government, which looks at how technology can transform modern government. And before we jump into our conversation, and I sincerely hope, and I don't think that I'm pulling a Brent Musburger moment right now, for anyone who follows your Twitter handle, you would have seen a photo that you posted from the red carpet weekend. And I just want to say that your wife in that photo was an absolute vision.
Oh, thank you.
And could you please tell everybody why I'm making such a big to-do about the way she looked on Oscar night?
Nice setup. I mean, there's nothing worse than a politician on a red carpet, particularly at the Oscars, unless they're there legitimately. And so, Adam, I appreciate the setup because my wife, I was her plus one. She was nominated as a producer for an Oscar for a documentary called The Invisible War about the issues of rape and sexual assault in the military. They won the Spirit Award the day before. They came just short on Oscar night, but I'm very proud of her. She is now followed up with another documentary she did a couple years ago. This is a follow-up to that called Misrepresentation, about the misrepresentation of women in media and politics. And so I couldn't be more proud. And she's pregnant with my third child. So thank you.
Now, your book is something of a manifesto. You write that you want to radically rethink the relationship between citizens and government.
Yeah.
And you say at the very beginning of the book that Americans are less engaged with their government. And the implication is less engaged than they were before. So I want to start by challenging you on that. Are we, in fact, less engaged than we always have been? Or have we always been a bunch of apathetic citizens?
Well, I think there are a couple trend lines. We've certainly seen the voter participation numbers drop in the last few decades. We're now 138th in the world in voter participation. 138th.
That's a percentage of a voter eligible?
Yeah, they're actually participating on Election Day. Just consider that I was just down in Los Angeles this morning. I'll be back tomorrow. They're having a mayoral race next week. Most of the pundits agree if more than 10% of people actually turn out to vote, it will be impressive. Shouldn't surprise anyone from L.A. because their last big election, non-presidential election, 12% of people showed up. The previous election, 13. None of these are headlines again anymore because they're trend lines. It's the new norm. Those are registered voters. So you're talking about single-digit participation in terms of active engagement now on Election Day. Now, you extend that, and of course, the point of this book is moving beyond elections. Governing is not getting elected. Governing is the hard work of actually day in and day out improving the lives of your constituents. That citizen engagement, I would argue, drops even further. There was a time when we had robust citizen engagement. The sort of history of this country, the notion of that town hall, Tocqueville talks so eloquently about how civically minded Americans were disproportionate to other countries he had visited. And we've lost a sense of that. We've lost a sense of community. We've lost a sense of engagement and connection to our government and governing institutions.
And before we get to your prescription, why has this happened?
Well, because we're treated as subjects, not citizens. We watch government, local, state, and federal government do things to us, but not with us. We're living in a world where we want choice, and we expect choice. You don't get much choice in government. Government operates more like a vending machine. Donald Kettle wrote about this, a political scientist, many years ago. It didn't get much attention, but it's something that really struck a chord with me. The idea that you put in a dollar of taxes and you get limited choices. Police, fire, healthcare, education, national security. If you don't like what you get, you do what a lot of us do with vending machines. You shake the machine. You'll kick the machine. You'll protest the Occupy movement, the Tea Party, and the like. And it's that framework of scarcity. It's that machine thinking that causes so much of the angst and frustration. You vote, I decide. And that framework, that broadcast model, where we amplify your voices to get elected, but then we turn them off after Election Day, is growing thinner and thinner in terms of your engagement, expectation, and willingness to continue in that perpetual, what I would argue at times, fraud.
Now, fraud on the part of government officials.
That we claim to be so civically minded. We claim to think your voice matters. We claim to assert that by having a town hall meeting every 3 to 6 or 9 months, and any of you that have been to a town hall meeting that actually could carve the time out to do it, we'll discover, as most town hall meetings, that the loudest voices tend to drown out the rest of us. And there isn't really a two-way conversation. It tends to be a one-way conversation, and a few voices are heard, and that's it. You're not participating in your budget process in a meaningful way. You may show up at a hearing about a particular budget item, but 99.9%, and I truly am not exaggerating, that budget is already baked. So you're debating a small percentage. So people are figuring that out. They're frustrated. They've been holding out for the guy or gal on the white horse to come in and save the day. We bring in Schwarzenegger. Disappoints us. Some of us expected Obama to do the same. Some have been disappointed. Others less so. And so my book is about three things. It's about leadership, fundamentally. It's about technology, absolutely. But it's also, again, about citizenship and active citizen engagement.
Now, I want to stick with leadership for a moment. You threw out the word fraud, and I'm fascinated by that, because there's a conventional wisdom that public servants aren't in it for public service. They're in it to, I don't know, get rich, exercise power, go to fancy parties. I don't know what people think their problem is with public officials. So let me ask you, number one, why are you in public service? Number two, what do you think the majority of politicians in the United States are in it for?
I think they're good folks trapped in a terrible system. You know, we speaking of the Oscars, we're all quoting Lincoln now, because that wonderful movie. But one quote I haven't heard is my favorite quote of Lincoln. He said, "We're all born originals, but we die copies." And I think of that in the context of campaigns. You know, I love these politicians when they're campaigning. They're saying all the right things. They seem so original and creative. And then I look back and I say, well, what happened to them? They're all termed out the same. It's as if the process of governing and campaigning has de-geniused them. And it begs then the question, perhaps President Obama, as candidate Obama, was right when he said, we can't just change the players. We need to change the game. And the system is what I'm critical of, not the individuals. I think the overwhelming majority of politicians on both sides of the aisle are eager to do the right thing. They're good people that want to contribute. I'll be honest, I am overwhelmed at times by the quality, I mean this, of people trapped in this terrible system that can't exercise their authenticity and their voice in a meaningful way. It's the system that we need to change.
And so we're going to spend a lot of time on technology this evening. Before we do, one thing that occurs to me, I mean, in this fabled era when citizens were more involved, the technology didn't allow them to see their leaders very often. Maybe they heard them on the radio, maybe they saw them on the television occasionally, maybe they would attend a meeting where they spoke. But today we see our leaders, if we want to, we see them constantly. And during campaigns, we see them too much. And I just want to I want to pose the question, did technology get us into this problem in the first place? Are public servants too ubiquitous?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. I mean, we certainly see people, but again, it's still a broadcast model. We're still talking to you, times at you. There's no real feedback loop for active citizen participation. No, there are efforts and attempts to create them, not just town hall meetings. We do petition sites, don't we? We have one. The president just created We the People. Fabulous idea. Jay Carney has been told by the president, anytime the citizens of this country have more than 5,000 petition signatures, virtual or physical signatures, we will respond. You may recall there was an audacious CNN spokesperson, talk show host that disagreed with some members of the NRA. His name, Pierce Morgan. And folks decided to sign petitions, tens of thousands, to deport this man back to the country that forced us to bear arms in the first place. And Carney was there, not discussing the withdrawal of troops in Afghanistan or the issues of drone strikes and the controversies. He had to acknowledge this petition. Of course, what did the president do, administration? They just raised the threshold of signatures now to 25,000. But people are now at 100,000 calling for a new Death Star to be created. And so the whole process is not necessarily been advantageous to the president or to this country. The problem is that's about participation in the abstract. That's about petitioning. I'm arguing about participating. I don't want to just petition government to do something for me. That's the machine model that I was arguing for. I want to create a new platform of citizen engagement where we can co-produce, we can co-collaborate, we can coordinate, we can cultivate each other's ideas, we can connect to that intelligence that exists latently inside of every one of you and network that in a more meaningful engagement. And so that's the fundamental of this book, not just petitioning, but real engagement.
And so...
Well, that's one person.
Why not? And what I liked about your book a lot is you have a bunch of examples of what you'd like to do. Some of them are very serious, and some of them, I think you even said, are somewhat silly.
Yeah.
So give us one example of how you want government to have a two-way conversation with its citizens, with citizens.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, and I appreciate, Adam, that there's so many wonderful examples that are out there. And I had some fun finding ones that I thought were cute, some that were more scalable and substantive, others that were ridiculous. But what I found interesting is this notion of civic currency. This idea that you can take the online engagement that exists and translate it offline and create real community. A young man in Manor, Texas, a town of 5,000 outside of Austin, Texas, came up with an idea called Manor Labs. And he created something called InnoBucks, virtual dollars, civic dollars, where individual citizens that engaged in community building, volunteering, cultivating a community by engaging in civic actions, or supporting mentorship programs, or volunteering in their community, etc., were given virtual points, InnoBucks, dollars online. They didn't have any real-world value, but they had a reputational value, a civic currency. The local newspaper decided to raise awareness and celebrate that kind of activity. As a consequence, civic engagement increased exponentially because people wanted to be recognized.
Measured how?
Measured by the amount of virtual dollars people received on a point system.
How did
on
civic
the basis,
engagement increase?
Because people were attracted to this idea and they wanted to participate and they liked the reputational component of it and they liked the scorecard. What happened is businesses decided to take those virtual dollars and actually translate them, and you can submit those dollars online, offline, for discounts in local merchant stores. It was a simple idea. This is not a profound idea per se, but it's an interesting idea. Others have used game technology. You all remember, I think most of us do, how a bill becomes a law because of that 3.5-minute wonderful little cartoon that we all remember. Do you remember, most of you remember that? Yeah. That bill on Capitol Hill, Schoolhouse Rock. And we were entertained and we were educated. The only thing that wasn't included was lobbyists that have been a real education. But the idea of that struck me as important because you know this, you write about this all the time. The amount of time we're spending online playing games is extraordinary. And it's not just young boys in the basement. It's increasingly women, middle-aged women, that are spending the majority of this disproportionate amount of time online. 500 million people around the world spending, half a billion people spending an hour a day on online games. If you're 21 years or younger, you've probably spent more time playing online games than you have in school.
So let's be clear about something, because as I look out in this audience, there's a few digital, what you call, you didn't make this up, what, digital natives in the room. There's more people in the room who are not digital natives.
Digital immigrants.
Digital immigrants. Those of us who had to learn this as we got older. And to make this very clear, You are suggesting that that we should embrace this gamification concept and harness it for government.
It's just another one of the examples, another, as I say, tool in the toolkit to answer your question. I mean, that's the rift, Citizenville on Farmville in Zynga. I mean, you can't make that up. But Mark Pincus is a friend of mine, and those of you who followed a little bit of my time as mayor, I brought Mark up to stage many times because he was the one employer in San Francisco that constantly was looking for new employees at a time when the markets were collapsing and everyone was laying folks off. And I asked him, what is this you're doing? He talked about this thing called Farmville. And you can't make it up because he's sitting there saying, well, you know, people will go online and play games and they'll cultivate virtual gardens and then they purchase tools to cultivate even more. And I said, what do you mean purchase? He says, they'll actually use their credit card and spend lots of money to cultivate virtual farms. I said, well, what's the benefit? Just pure entertainment. Guys, you know, worth hundreds of millions of dollars now. And so it just woke me up to this notion of games, social games, games for goods, games that can educate us and enliven our senses, connect us to causes and purpose. And so it's just another example of meeting people where they are. And that's a principle of engagement. You've got to meet people where they are. We are spending more time online. I mean, it's Eric Schmidt said it better than anyone else, you remember, said we have two states, asleep and online. That's the world we're living in.
God, I hope he's wrong, but I'm willing to go with you for the time being.
In all seriousness, though, you are aware that there are concerns that Farmville is a fad and Zynga's not doing great, and could your suggestions be fadish?
But gaming
also
is growing exponentially broadly, and social game movements are growing significantly. And so I think beyond just the Zynga and whether or not its post-IPO reality is successful or not, the larger principle, I think, applies here.
I would suggest that your ideas on gamification are plucky. I'm more impressed with your concept around something you call Rate My DMV. Would you talk about that?
Well, Yelp inspires me. You know, Jeremy Stoppelman. And this idea, you know, and I'm in the restaurant business, so I didn't particularly like Yelp when it started. wasn't good to us. But I love the power of it. And, you know, I was talking to Jeremy. I said, why is it just restaurants? He says, well, we're not just restaurants and bars and cafes. He said, you can rate anything. And I didn't fully realize that. And it occurred to me that if we used Yelp-like rating service for government services, for the DMV, for paying parking tickets down at DPT, or the building and planning commissions, recreation and parks, that would trigger a lot of controversy, a lot more transparency in terms of quality, and we would be forced to measure our efficacy in a different way. There is a program called Rate My Professor that does just that, where a lot of students go online, I didn't know this, and they'll actually make a determination, not just based on the course, but the quality of the professor based on their network of friends that are rating those professors. So I want to take those values, those principles, those are ideas of using technology in a way to raise the bar of engagement and expectation of reform and efficiency and effectiveness.
So when is the state of California going to institute this?
This is tough. Now this is, so you know, how many of you heard about the scandal in the state recreation and parks department, all that money? Most of you, right? How many of you are aware of the California's efforts to upgrade our case management system for the courts? Exactly.
One court worker raised their hand.
So I want to make this point because I think this just underscores it. This is rather stunning to me, but not surprising. The courts management system was established in a new reform, well-intended and long overdue, in 2004. $260 million was identified to upgrade their case management system. Thank God. Amen. Good for them. It was going to be done in 2008, $260 million. In 2009, they reflected on the fact they had already spent over $500 million, that one subcontractor had 103 change orders on his $33 million component, and he had already spent $100 million, and it was time to reconsider the project. They did so, but they did it first by assessing what it would cost to complete it. $260 by 2008 became $1.9 billion by 2015. Now, you want to talk scandals.
Yeah.
You want to be outraged. There's hundreds of millions of dollars of your money you didn't know about. But you know what you didn't know about? The scandal at the Parks Department of money that wasn't spent. Of money we still have in the account. What an outrage. I'm with you.
Keep going.
No one should be pleased with that. I'm
not. Who's at fault? Who?
Well, I just think it's interesting what we prioritize. $208 million DMV upgrade. This matters to me and every single one of you in this room. $208 million DMV upgrade. Los Angeles Times last week. What happened? They fired HP. They're not even halfway done. They spend more than half the money. And guess what we're left with? 40-year-old technology that the head of the DMV acknowledges could collapse any day and the entire system will come to a screeching halt.
So let me ask you, who's responsible for this?
We all are.
No, but I mean, whose job is it? Whose job is on the line for this?
Well, let me say we all are. I don't know if you've been on the 405 in Southern California, which means you're just in traffic, right? So there's a great billboard that says, "You're not stuck in traffic." And you go, what the hell are you talking about? Excuse my language. You're stuck in traffic. You go. It says underneath, you are traffic. Think about that. So you ask me who's at fault? We are. We've accepted this. It's the norm. We've accepted the lack of reporting and transparency. We've accepted the big IT agencies to continue to come in and try to build out these top-down systems with multi-year contracts. We're accepting the notion that we can still build big IT departments, period. We're still not in the cloud. I'm the only state agency that went to the cloud, and I just broke all the rules and just brought my own team up there to do it. We're living in an on-demand world, and we're still stuck in this analog frame. We're all to blame. We're all responsible. But at the end of the day, your representatives certainly are more accountable than any others, and that includes me. And so the answer to your question is, I wrote a book because I was infuriated by my inability to move that frame of thinking and to change the culture, even as lieutenant governor. And so I wrote a book to expose it, now to begin the process of doing something about it.
So, you know, it would be helpful, though, and since you're not going to engage on this specifically, but there is a senior level bureaucrat or a senior level elected official, Governor Brown perhaps, who ought to be responsible for a massive cost overrun like that. But
yeah.
There
well,
isn't.
In this case, the courts as an enterprise agency was responsible for managing the court system. The DMV as an enterprise agency was responsible for managing that system. Interesting, the connections here. You have general fund, state general fund, discretionary funds, and then you have these agencies that basically generate their own revenue that goes back in. That's where there's almost complete lack of transparency are in those agencies. The general fund gets all the attention and the sunshine and light of day, but not those agencies because they're self-funding. But what happens is they fee and fine you to death, and you're being taxed for that inefficiency, but not general fund tax. You're just taxed with paying more for your licenses every year, paying more for your parking tickets every year, paying more to actually submit a brief at the courts every single year to make up for that inefficiency. And we get away with that because, again, you've allowed us to get away with that because we are operating with opacity and not transparency. This book is also about openness. It's about a default of openness that is much bigger than politicians. It's about what lies beneath. It's the plumbing, the stuff that really matters underneath it, and being more transparent in terms of our data sets and being more accountable in terms of our ability for you to understand what's really going on in government.
And I think there's, you know, to stick with this Rate My DMV topic, there's broad consensus in this room that we like this idea. So just explain to us how we can make it happen.
Well,
what should we do to get this happen by, to make this happen by, let's say, next year?
We do. President Obama did some amazing things. One of the first things he did, his first executive order, the dreaded executive order, Fox at least believes, all those executive orders, he did an open data initiative. He started putting data sets on every agency of government to take data. Not dissimilar to what Ronald Reagan interestingly did that has benefited every single one of you in this room, even if you can't stand the guy. And that is, in the 80s, Reagan took all that satellite data that you pay for as taxpayers, that used to generate and still does a remarkable amount of data, but that was put in the vaults of the National Oceanic atmospheric agency, NOAA. And it was used for our purposes, for government. He decided to open up that platform. Government still accesses it, but so can everybody else. And as a consequence, you benefited today by using the GPS in your car to get where you may have gotten today. You may have gone on your iPhone to determine, is this weather getting better? Is it warming up? What's the weekend look like? Your AccuWeather, the Weather Channel. All of these things were created because we opened up this data set. What other treasure of data exists at the Recreation and Parks Department, at the DMV, at agencies large and small, all over state government, federal government, and local government? So the principal thing, the first thing we need to do is create a similar ordinance to require data sets to be made public. San Francisco, when I was mayor, we became the first city in the country to do this. And you know what happened? We created an online app store. Because when you put the data up, these smart third-party developers, these are the same folks that have created all the apps that you have downloaded on your iPhone and Android platforms, that took that same data, scraped it together, and came up with wonderful ideas that cost not a penny to the taxpayers. And so we have an app store in San Francisco. Other cities are doing the same thing. Well, you download apps for crime mapping technology to learn about crime rates. You're able to cross-reference those with real estate listings and homes that are on the market, determine block by block what the crime activity is and before you buy and purchase a home. Yelp now is using health data that is being made available and linking it to those restaurant reviews. And so it won't be long before, because of the nature of localized services and mobility, that you walk by a restaurant and it literally will pop up that their health scores are below average, subpar, even before you make a determination of going to that restaurant. These are ways of using government data to improve services and ultimately improve transparency and trust as a consequence.
Can we make this happen with a gubernatorial executive order, or do we need legislation to do this?
I originally did it through executive order as mayor, and then I codified it when I knew I was leaving because I wanted to make sure it was legislated and transcended my time and tenure. But Governor Brown can move aggressively to do just this as the executive of the state of California, ask all its department and agency heads, give me 10 data sets of relevance, and I want to put these things up, raw data sets, in a machine, what they call machine readable way, which means they can easily be downloaded, and you watch what happens with these private partners we create. When Steve Jobs, this was the genius of Jobs. Steve Jobs, Apple doesn't do apps. They came out with that, you know this, he wrote the book.
Thank you.
But, I better be careful and accurate here. But when they came on the iPhone, you can remind me, they did, I think, less than a dozen apps just to get people's appetites wet. And Jobs' point was, this is a platform. And as a consequence, Apple's now partnered with millions of people, over 800,000 apps and counting on that platform, Android over 700,000. And that's the same, this notion of government as a platform versus government as a vending machine is a core construct, a value proposition that I'm arguing for in this book.
And it's actually better than that. They actually screwed up. They didn't see the opportunity. And when there were so many third-party hackers hacking into the iPhone, they said, wow, this is a good idea. And they had the presence of mind to create the App Store. What does Governor Brown think of your idea?
Well, I'm hoping that he reads the book.
Did you give him a copy yet?
I have not had the opportunity. See, he's been out of town. Didn't things go well last week in California? I thought so. Governor was at it. I was acting governor. I'm just saying.
Were you here last week?
Yeah. I was all over the state. Yeah, I was here in L.A. I thought things went well. But anyway, that's an aside.
Still in one piece.
Yeah, I know. But Brown did arrive last night, so I can't be totally accountable for your evening. But I'm hopeful. But I know a lot of the IT folks have as well. But what I've done, Adam, is, my whole thinking is bottom-up thinking, not top-down thinking. If there's any disappointment I have with the Obama administration, and I'm a huge fan and supporter, is I wish he has governed as he campaigned. In 2008, 35,000 self-organizing communities, remarkable, came together. But those voices in 2009, 10, 11 were not amplified. They were turned off. And famously, you may recall, the president, to his credit, said, this is something remarkable, and I want to keep this going. And he tried, by creating something called change.gov. And during the transition, he had a big town hall meeting. You may recall this, infamous, where he said, is the letter to everyone, let's keep this engagement. Let's change the world. Again, not changing players. Let's change the game. Let's change the culture of Washington. What's on your mind? We've got a war in Afghanistan, war in Iraq. We've got a war on terror, challenges of climate change, and we've got a financial calamity on our hands. What's on your mind? Let us know. Come together. And just like Michelle Obama the other night, the envelope, please. The president came out, opened it up, and what did people want? What was their number one priority? 2, 3, 4? Legalize marijuana. That was his reaction. And he made a flippant remark, and the online community was furious. And as a consequence, Google it right now. See what happened to change.gov. It went down for reconstruction and became the new White House website. They transitioned out of that two-way engagement. So this is tough stuff.
But this is fascinating. I mean, I'll play devil's advocate with you and suggest that the people blew it. They, in fact, gave a frivolous response to the people to a serious question. That was not anywhere near the most important problem facing the country. And I would submit that the president and serious politicians like you would do well to ignore stupid feedback like that. I'm being very serious.
No, and I appreciate that, except for the online community, they take offense to that notion. They take that damn seriously. You know, politicians do when they campaign. We go to the NAACP talking about the war on drugs being an abject failure, disproportionately incarcerating minorities, and that perpetual reality of incarceration and parole and probation and how it's costing taxpayers billions of dollars and how it's destroying generation. And then they argue for specific examples of tax and regulate. And then politicians just dismiss it out of hand as frivolous and unimportant when it is important to millions of people. So I think we have to be careful. And this is my point in the book. If you're going to engage in that two-way conversation, you better commit yourself to that. Mm-hmm. And that's been the struggle, was the struggle there. And he didn't need to be flippant. Mm-hmm. He could have said, I respect that this is important. Mm-hmm. And I value that. And here's what I'm going to do. You know, when in doubt, we have a task force. Or I'm going to call you, right? But he didn't. And he didn't allow that to gestate in a way where we can then engage in other things that matter to people most. And I think that's, so we just have to be careful about that. And that's why, again, people sort of pulled away. And that's why, again, I'm not just arguing for petitions. I'm arguing for creating a new mechanism for active engagement, a new platform that moves past the king of the hill point you're making, where the loudest voices are not just at a town hall, but are online organizing around their particular pet cause.
You know, what's fascinating about your thesis, at a high level, you know, you will never have to debate with anyone about whether or not you are a progressive in the American context, right? You sealed your fate on that.
Yes.
With gay marriage. And so that's over. And yet, if you read what you wrote and you listen carefully,
yeah.
Conservatives, people who are anti-government, will take away from your message, gee, you're giving us some good ideas about how to get rid of this government stuff that we frankly don't like.
I have been alarmed by that. I say lovingly. It's unbelievable the response I've gotten from conservatives. Without talking out of school, because he did a big blog post on this, Newt Gingrich. Said, must read Citizenville. I said, I got to reread it.
Wait a second. If it helps sell books,
to
though.
Your point, yeah, I mean, here I'm Mr. Universal Health Care, gay marriage. I got strong opinions on drug policy and, you know, all those other things we do, and highest minimum wage in this town. You have universal preschool. Heck, been there, done that with all the debates in D.C. But I get it, because the framework is very much the Founding Fathers' framework. This is sort of a Jeffersonian ideal. Interesting, Clinton really picked up on this with the DLC years ago. Remember, the era of big government is over. We want more opportunity, not bureaucracy. He quoted from Jefferson a lot about this idea of individual liberty and self-government. Even President Obama, 2 years ago in his State of the Union, quoted Lincoln in another context, saying, as Lincoln said, government should do nothing more than what individuals can do better for themselves. Even Obama quoted that. And so those are, in some respects, some principles as it relates to technology, creating an opportunity for active citizen engagement where those app stores and third-party developer citizens can begin to be more collaborative and begin to design services and move away from this notion that government has to do everything for everybody all of the time.
And do you think the president has been successful in following through on that admonition?
He said in that speech later, and this is a quick 30-second answer, Remember, we all have themes. 2 years ago was Built to Last. 3 years ago was Win the Future. And he said, you cannot win the future with a government from the past. I like it. He said, we have 15 agencies that are responsible for exports, 5 that are responsible for housing, and my favorite, he said, is salmon. We have a regulatory regime that says salmon, when they're in freshwater, are regulated by the Interior Department, but as soon as they make their way out to the ocean, they're regulated by commerce.
Makes total sense.
Comma, today there are 15 agencies responsible for exports, 5 agencies responsible for housing, and the new Interior Secretary and Commerce Secretary will share different responsibilities as it relates to salmon. It sounded good, but we haven't done terrible language good. So there's a lot of good rhetoric on this, but we're still working in silos. His point was 15 agencies to do one thing. You don't operate the technology, you don't exist, you don't succeed in technology by dealing in silos. We deal in interests, but government still operates in silos. And this is a new clash. This is profound. I was with Tom Freeman, who I represent in the book, in this conversation we had down in Silicon Valley, and he made the point about this. If you think I'm exaggerating, this technology stuff, and the guy's a little bit hyperbolic, a little too idealistic, this is a little bit exaggerated, this is a little fanciful, you know, I read all those magazines that said we would never have to walk again on sidewalks because there'd be conveyor belts as well. Never happened. But consider Freeman's point. You know, his book, The World is Flat. If you bought that, please buy mine. Because I know how many people bought his.
You want a fraction of
it. Right. It was on the Times bestseller in 2005. And he made the point. You know, I asked him this rhetorical question. What world are we living in? Because it's the one question we never ask ourselves in government. And it's the most important question. It's the one question we should wake up every single day asking ourselves. What world are we living in? And he said, I'll answer it by saying this. In 2005, my book, The World of Flat, was on the New York Times bestseller. And do you know Facebook was not even in there? And he said the whole book was about technology and globalization, that we're a connected world. Facebook wasn't in there. He said Twitter was a sound. The cloud was in the sky. 4G was a parking space. LinkedIn, a prison. Apps were things you filled out to get into USF. And Skype, for most of us, was a typo. Think about that. Those things are ubiquitous in our lives. They didn't exist as we know them just a few years ago. This is not 1985 or 95. And I argue in that context that the industrial age is running out of steam. It has served us extraordinarily well. But these large hierarchical institutions, not just in government, but in the private sector, have all begun to collapse. Look at the media industry. Newspapers. It's obvious in hindsight, but I remember the debates not that long ago where people were still holding on to this belief that this technology stuff wasn't going to change the game. You saw the same. I've seen it in publishing. I'm learning it now intimately. The music industry, what Jobs did, what you've written so eloquently about, it wasn't just radicals in Napster when he made that deal with those industries. Now we're buying songs customized to our taste, recommending new songs. Not big record albums, things we don't want. You're seeing that in the same financial service industry, big brokerage houses. I have a family, a bunch of brokers. They long for those old black and white movie days of 1990s when they're getting those huge fat commissions and you had no choice until the Schwabs and others came along in E-Trade. And we're seeing the same contours of this change in government is my point, except government is not responding to this. And I think we're on a collision course with the future. I really do. And so that's, again, what I call out in this book.
So we're going to go to questions in just a moment. And so if you'd like to line up at the microphone right now, that would be great. And I'll just ask one last very broad question before we go to the audience, which is, are our taxes too high in the state of California?
For some, they are. For others, they're not. You know, we have the highest income taxes in the United States. We have among the highest corporate taxes, among the highest capital gains taxes, and among the highest sales taxes. We have relatively modest property taxes. So in some categories, we're off the charts. In other categories, we're competitive. But we also have local taxes, not just those state taxes, and they're combined with the federal taxes. I think tax reform, I mean real reform in California, is long overdue.
And I think we do need to be more competitive in more categories, not just a few. And I do think it's hurting our competitiveness. I have long been a pro-job Democrat, which means by definition I'm a pro-business Democrat, because I don't think you can be pro-jobs and anti-business. Now, I say that as a guy with 17 small businesses and close to 1,000 employees. I'm passionate about this, and I don't say that to impress you, but to impress upon you my entrepreneurial passion and respect for small business owners that put everything on the line to make a go at it. And I think California needs to celebrate that and embrace that. We do not have a economic development plan in the state. We shut down our trade and commerce agency in 2003 at a time when Friedman was writing "The World is Flat" and making the point that we're no longer connected but a hyper-connected world, a gateway to Asia, and there's not one foreign office. Finally, Brown's heading out there in a few months to China to finally open an office. San Francisco, we opened three when I was mayor because I wasn't waiting around for the state of California. There's no manufacturing plan, no export plan, and frankly, it's gotten short shrift in Sacramento.
So when you are governor, where will tax reform rate on your list of your priorities?
When Jerry's in China, I will be.
I don't think that's going to give you enough time.
Won't be enough time.
All right, please identify yourself. Please ask your question briefly and make it a question, not a statement. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Saheli Dada, and I just wanted to maybe return to the example of the furor over the legalization of marijuana, because I was curious, what do you think of the idea that people feel that the lack of response is because their elected representatives are listening to lobbyists or policymakers or corporations or whoever, that they don't have to tell us who they're listening to? And what do you think of making your schedule and everybody you talk to every day open to everybody?
Yeah. Well, I talk about that at length in the book and answer that question in detail. So I'm encouraging you to buy the book to see the answer. And I'm also arguing that we've got to go so far past this, the politician's schedule. My God, end of the day, that's important, but it's trivial in the context of government and what's really happening that we're not exposed to, and we don't necessarily seem to have an appetite. I'm more interested, frankly, where my department heads, who they're meeting with. Are they meeting with lobbyists for all these contracts on big IT things? Are they having dinner with these folks? I mean, that scares the... because they're the ones recommending to me that we go with this group or that group, and I'm deferring to them. And we tend not to be so interested in what's happening, again, underneath. That said, this issue, you know, I have a critique of government. If you want to move the mouse, you've got to move the cheese. You have to change incentives. And we have incentives in government for bad behavior. You're getting exactly what you should expect to get on this sequestration debate. Everyone is protecting their self-interest. You're getting exactly what you should expect. I can't believe we expect anything differently because the incentives align to this behavior. So we have to change that framework. The incentives in a world where the parties dominate, where the parties do not respect those that cross over and reach across the divide. In a world where redistricting and gerrymandering means we've chosen you, you haven't chosen us, and we lock down those votes, creates an ideological rigidity where people are more scared, not the general election, but being primaried. And so is it a surprise that a guy like John Cornyn, the number two senator, the Republicans, one of the most powerful people in the United States, is under quote-unquote cruise control? Because this firebrand Ted Cruz, this Tea Partier in his home state, has got him so scared about his 2014 reelection that he may be primaried by the Tea Party that he won't do anything without consulting and aligning himself with Ted Cruz. And it exists on the left as well. And then you add money into this and the persuasion industry, special interests that move in. And you've got a toxic environment.
But your top description would be more transparency as a start.
Yeah, and it's not just about, it's more transparency in the broadest sense of the word. And, you know, because you can't avoid it now, right? WikiLeaks. If you think you can avoid it, think of WikiLeaks. Anonymous, these black hat hackers, these white hat hackers, It's the Freedom of Information Act. I mean, as Stuart Brandon said, information wants to be free, invariably will be. The stress of President Obama on the drones, this ready, fire, aim policy, a kill list of American citizens, and the question of due process, where the president himself, the most transparent president in our history, and I believe he has been, he self-declared that a few weeks ago, and I agreed with him, but on this issue, is default exactly the person he was criticizing when he was Senator Obama running for president. We've got to reframe that.
So I want to remind our listening audience that this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's InForum, Connect Your Intellect, and that tonight we are hosting Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom of California talking about his book, Citizenville. I'm Adam Leshinsky with Fortune Magazine. Please.
Hi, my name is Lakshya Natarajan. I'm from San Mateo High School. And as a high school student in a political debate organization, I can tell you that I really admire and I really appreciate your straightforwardness and no-nonsense attitude, especially with concerned citizens like us. So my question to you is, why aren't our other elected officials doing this?
Well, a lot of them are. You know, I'm past my sell-by date. I can't believe I'm still in politics. I mean, I can't believe you've let me continue. I mean that. You know, I'm blessed. You know, I have a world I can fall back on. A lot of folks don't. This is their life, their career. This is their mortgage. This is their kids' education. And they've worked hard to get there. And they want to make a difference. But they have to be a hell of a lot more cautious than perhaps a guy like me does. And I respect that. You know, but I'm disappointed in it because you know what? We don't have leaders leading anymore. They're quarreling. And I think we need leadership again. I said this book's about leadership. And I just don't think we're talking enough about that. It's about citizenship and leadership. And those two go hand in hand. And so, you know, I get to say what I think. And, you know, I survived. I thought truly, you know, look, 9 years ago this week, I honestly thought I'd be recalled. I would be arrested, and I'd be out of office. I'm not exaggerating.
What happened 9 years ago?
Gay marriage. You know, you remember, we all act, oh, it's San Francisco. Hold on. That whole west side of this town was not behind my actions of gay marriage. My father sure as heck wasn't. I mean, he was an activist judge on the California Court of Appeals who said, I'm all for this gay right, but can't you just call it something else? And it was, you know, it was an audacious time. And so I survived that. And you know what? I look back and it gave me some confidence. Well, what else can I say that I think? And so it shouldn't surprise you that there was only one statewide Democrat, statewide, that supported repealing of the death penalty, that supported amending the three strikes law. There was no other statewide politician that came out for those two initiatives, not one. And they're all progressive Democrats. I just am not as cautious on these things. I'd rather you disagree with me, but I sure as heck, I just want you to know where I'm coming from. And by the way, I said the other day, and good people can disagree, and I've evolved on this. I really have. But I just think our laws on marijuana are doing more harm than good. And I finally said that to the New York Times. And, you know, and again, there are not many politicians that were lining up behind me on that recently. And all those things are liabilities, because I was on the wrong side of the death penalty issue. I was on the wrong side of the people in California on gay marriage. Certainly Prop 8 proved that. I'm on the wrong side of legalizing marijuana. But my gosh, look at Prop 19. But I get to say what I think. And so good people on all sides, they want to do the right thing. Some are hamstrung, some are not. Some totally disagree and are authentic. But I guess I can only speak for myself.
Over here, please.
Hi, my name is Rachel Niederman. I'm a teacher, and so I'm curious how you envision technology helping to transform the education system.
Oh, thank you.
He's been waiting for that question because I didn't ask it. Thank you.
This has given me so much optimism. I am so bored to tears with these debates around seniority and tenure as if somehow that's going to solve the educational crisis in this state. I mean, fine, you can have them. If you think that's reform, I think you have fooled yourself or you've been spun such a lousy tale. Because there are a lot of states without seniority and tenure, and they're not outperforming in any significant way. I mean, you know all the international stats on this. But there is something profound happening that is very exciting, and technology is playing a critical role. Guys like Sal Khan and the Khan Academy, where we're saying, you know what, this 150 years of having kids in rows of desks with bells that were ringing when the founding fathers were alive, having kids based on their date of manufacture in those desks, time of birth, with single subjects, having a professor lecture to them, kids with pens quickly trying to write down what the professor said. Those days are numbered, thank God. It's no longer relevant to the world we're living in. And guys like Sal Khan said, you know what? Why don't we flip the classroom? Instead of doing homework at home, we're going to do it in the classroom. Instead of having teachers that are lecturing us and broadcasting us like politicians do, we're going to have teachers that are mentors and are coaches. Instead of lining people up in desks, we're going to get them around tables. Instead of having everyone based on their date of manufacture, their date of birth, we're going to have different age cohorts, because every single one of us are interacting with people not just of their age. And we're going to have a mentor-mentee relationship. Instead of standardized subjects in learning, mass education, fast food education, we're going to have customized curriculum, individualized learning, and blended learning and application. And you're seeing that not just with Khan and K-12, but now with guys like Sebastian Thrun, Udacity University, Coursera, and edX, and higher education, where they're now taking these same tools of this feedback, iterative combination of technology, measurement, feedback loops to begin to radically change the way we educate people in college as well. So I'm actually extraordinarily optimistic about the future.
And in your opinion, because you have vast experience with this, will the teachers' unions be as enthusiastic about online education as you are?
My friends in the teachers' union...
That's a politician's way of starting the answer.
Well, I do have a lot of... I think they will, and I think increasingly they're coming on board. I think some of the biggest innovators are teachers. And I think this is not just the politician. I've met some labor leaders that are more aggressive on reform than even I am. But they're constantly in this state of defense and assault from their perspective, fighting these fights on things like tenure and seniority, yep, and just holding on to their piece of the pie. And we can't even get to that pace of real deliberation and engagement. And that's the place we need to go.
Over here, please.
Hi, my name is Brianna Moore. I actually used to work in New York City at a big governmental institution. And we did feedback sessions with stakeholders when we were proposing different accountability policies. And we actually did take that information into account when setting those policies. So a nice feedback session, like you were talking about. But one thing I found challenging about doing those kinds of sessions is that when you work for a government institution, you have access to a lot of information, a lot of insider information, and a lot of knowledge about the rationale that goes into the decision-making process, which the average citizen doesn't have. And you mentioned that, you know, there's open data sources online and that kind of thing. I'm just wondering what kind of suggestions or thoughts do you have about transmitting information about the rationale for doing something other than just data? Because traditionally the media does this, and do you think there are other independent ways to go about it?
Well, there's some interesting things, and it's, and I mentioned these in the books, the facts lead where they lead, and I highlighted a number of Republicans that have done some very fascinating things, one called Project Madison, another one called Citizen Co-Sponsor, where they actually have total transparency as it relates to bills that are submitted in Congress and any amendments that were made that are annotated with notes as to why the amendments were made, where the ideas for the amendments came from, so you can walk through the entire process with real transparency. So there are examples out there where people are doing some remarkable things, but there's a more exciting example, and that is this idea of participatory budgeting. This has been done for years in Brazil to extraordinary success. Porto Alegre takes a quarter of their entire budget, and the electeds don't make the determination. Public and citizens make the determination where the budget goes. And it's not mob rule. It's not gone awry. It's not just everyone saying it's going into, you know, my graffiti programmer, anti-graffiti. It's remarkable, that engagement. And New York last year did a pilot. They started with $6 million, and they did a participatory budgeting. All the consensus afterwards is two things happened. More people engaged than ever, outstanding ideas that were implemented, and more African-Americans and Latinos participating than any other budget in the past. Interesting. So these are some examples where, again, technology can be used, examples that are all in the book, things we should be doing. If I were mayor again in San Francisco, I'd be doing a participatory budget tomorrow. I'd be very aggressive on creating that feedback loop and these citizen co-sponsor ideas so you can track that process of legislation. And these are ideas and values, by the way, that Mayor Lee supports, and he has just signed off on a challenge. Citizenville now, I'm trying to create, to the extent I can, a bit of a movement here, where I'm working with mayors, because I really think at the end of the day, the one form of government that's still working relatively well is local government. As much as we love to hate our local officials, it tends to be less ideological. Mayors make bad ideologues, and ideologues make terrible mayors. There's a hard-headed pragmatism. You got to get things done. And so Mayor Nutter of Philadelphia, Mayor of Austin, Texas, we have mayors all across the country that have signed off on the challenge with the principles we're advancing in this book, of these kinds of ideas and values. So we're trying to create a movement bottom up all across the country.
And just very briefly, aren't ballot initiatives a form of participatory government, and hasn't that just gone horribly?
Yeah. Well, certainly in California.
No, we don't have a monopoly on horrible ballot initiatives.
No, and that's always the fear, and this is such a good question, because I'm not arguing for direct democracy to replace representative democracy. Quite the contrary. Okay. The founders were very, very specific about this. They didn't want monarchy, nor did they want mob rule. They created separate branches of government so we would have cool minds and a level-headedness. The one branch, though, that we've forgotten is the people branch, real active citizen engagement. And so I'm calling for a hybrid in that respect, but not replace it. What's happened in California, just briefly, you all know this, you've lived it, is that we've locked in expenses,
yeah,
and we've locked out revenue.
Yeah.
And we've seen the persuasion industry special interest hijack our initiative process in this state, and we have to be cautious.
I'm sorry to say this is going to be the last question from
the audience. Oh, sorry, guys. Well, I'll be around. Buy a book, and I'll be around even longer.
I'm sorry.
My name is Ruchira Datta. As a digital native, I would like to push back a little bit. This sort of actually follows on from what you were just saying. So there is a cognitive bias towards short-sightedness in the human psyche. And Daniel Kahneman, for instance, talks about this in Thinking Fast and Slow. And you just referenced the cool minds. So there's sort of an automatic tendency towards thinking in the short term rather than thinking in the long term. And technology, we find, enhances that in every walk of life. So unless it's done consciously, it seems that bringing technology into government could have the potential to enhance short-sighted decisions over long-sighted decisions.
Yeah, I guess her question is, do you agree or disagree with her?
I agree with that. Of course, what do we have now? We've got a government that's exclusively focused on the next election, not the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
We have a government that's exclusively focused on situational values, whatever the situation called for, not sustainable values. And you're absolutely right. Certainly that can be heightened as it relates to these tools of technology. But I example all these efforts to try to deviate from those extremes. Quora.com, Delphi, Localocracy, and others that are creating these platforms for thoughtful civic engagement, taking the idea of the Agora, the Forum, 2,400 years ago, and the opportunity to bring in experts and unbiased information and to have a deliberative platform of engagement to come up with consensus. And technology is beginning to address some of those extreme elements, I think, in a very thoughtful and judicious way. Can I make one final point?
You're going to get another final point after that, but go ahead.
Leadership. My father used to talk about this all the time, and I referenced Tom Peters wrote a little bit about this as well. And I challenge you to think about this. What did Mandela, Gandhi, King, and Vaclav Havel all have in common at the peak of their influence? Mandela, King, Gandhi, and Havel, at the peak of their influence, what did they have in common?
Lack of ego.
All good. Jail time. Interesting fact. They also shared one other thing in common. None of them, at the peak of their influence, had formal authority. They didn't need to be something to do something. They shared their moral authority. And you can argue when Havel became president of Czechoslovakia and Mandela president of South Africa, they lost a little bit of their influence. So my point to all of you as citizens, as leaders, is don't wait around for the guy or gal on the white horse to disappoint you. It's time to step up and step in. The remarkable capacity you have now to self-organize, to connect people of like mind to a cause, as the Facebook youth in Tahrir Square did, as the Indignados in Spain are doing, as the Weibo bloggers, 250 million of them, that cannot be suppressed by the Chinese government with their version of China's Twitter, are doing. That's what these tools of technology are able to do, to amplify and democratize voices. So I want to encourage you all to step up and step in. Don't be inert. Be participatory. Be active.
And so I'm going to do a little twist on the way we were going to end the program, which was I was instructed to ask you to give us your 60-second idea to change the world. But I think you just gave us a two-word idea, which is step up. Is that fair?
Yeah. Exercise your moral authority. Exercise your moral authority. Exercise your voice. No one is an expert in everything. Everyone is an expert in something. How do we connect to that expertise, and that, as we say, networked intelligence? You have the tools now in your pocket to do things that only government could do in large organizations 5 or 10 years ago. You can engage peer-to-peer. You don't need an intermediary. You don't need someone to give you permission now. And that's the principle, again, behind this book.
I think that everyone in the room will agree with me, to play on something that you said at the outset in quoting Abraham Lincoln, that Gavin Newsom is not a copy. He is an original.
Nice of you.
Please join me in giving a round of applause to Gavin Newsom.
Thank you, Adam. Thank you, guys. Thank you. Thank you.
And not going to interrupt them when they're on a roll. And now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.
All right. Thank you. Thank you.